Welcome back, everyone, to Progressively Incorrect, a show all about dispelling some of the myths and in education and some of the weirder things in teaching. I'm really excited today to be talking about one of my favorite topics, which is math facts. Do we teach them? How do we teach them? And so on. And as you know, there are a couple of sponsors that we're going to talk about right now, including John Catt Educational, which published my book and lots of great evidence-informed books. I'd really reach out to the folks at John Catt. I will put a link to their catalog in the show notes. Check out what they have to say. If you are looking to publish a book, they specialize in getting teachers off the ground with publishing, and they're really focused on the topics of this podcast. So go check them out. Also, think about if you're an instructional coach, instructional leader, think about StepLab. I'm the director of StepLab North America. We do tons of events around the United States around instructional coaching. We are a platform and an approach to making systematic, explicit, responsive instructional coaching. Instructional coaching happen across various schools, 14,000 schools. So go ahead and check out the links in the show notes. Brian, you are on the podcast now, and how about you go ahead and introduce yourself? This has been a long time coming. I'm so excited to have you on.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be on as well. I'm a big fan. I love listening to your guests, and it's always a great place to come and learn. So my name is Brian Ponce. I'm a professor at Oklahoma State University, where I am the director of the EDS and PhD programs in school psychology. My research focus has been in academic intervention and tiered systems of support and behavioral learning theory. And a majority of what I do really is, school psychologists work with kids referred for a variety of problems. And so I really tackle the learning problem issues. And so we really focus on good, empirically validated instructional approaches to make sure every student learns.
Awesome. You know, there's so many folks that come out of psychology, out of behavior science programs that have been on this podcast. Why so many folks that are focused on kids with all sorts of learning difficulties, they tend to come out of like departments of psychology and like behavioral psychology in particular?
Yeah. Behaviorists, we're kind of sticklers on operational definitions. And ultimately, when we work with kids, we think it's really important not to assume a lot. So when we assess kids, we want to see, like, if somebody says, I want this child doesn't understand. We would be like, well, what do they do when they understand? And if you tell me what that is, then we can task analyze that, break those into component parts, and we can try to backfill those to increase the probability that the kid can make those linkages, right? So we're always talking about fluency building as psychologists. And I think the reason for that is we're working with kids that are referred later, and we have to backfill those skills. And we know that if kids have learning difficulties, and let's say they have some form of, and I'm not overly big into unalterable variables like processing difficulties, but if I'm working with an intellectually disabled kid, right, like I'm probably going to need to have them overlearn some of those component skills to set them up to efficiently learn the larger component skill, and then hopefully the composite skill. And so we have to be highly systematic about how we scope and sequence our instructional objectives and instruction. And so, of course, I think, some of the best people, in the universe at that are the precision teaching folks who, you've had on in the past, Kent Johnson and such. And so we just kind of, I think, follow, kind of in that footsteps. And furthermore, since these are such difficult children to teach, we don't take anything for granted. So we're really big into inductive hypothesis testing. We'll assess, we make a hypothesis, we put the instruction in place, and we look at how the child responds. We don't assume what we're going to do works. And so we're going to test it out. We're going to want to see a kid grow at certain rates. And if they don't, then we go back to the drawing board on the alterable variables we can control in the instructional environment, so we can, revisit, problem solve, and find what that child needs to be successful.
Excellent. And you mentioned component skills and composite skills. And composite skills, just really quickly, like there's multiple components within it. They probably are interacting, like in the cognitive load literature, they might talk about like high and element interactivity.
Yes.
But then the component skills, the most famous one, it must be in math education, are math facts, and even before then, like writing your numerals and things like that, like tool skills.
And what's crazy about that is we'll just use math facts alone, right? Like math facts for a kindergarten, first grader, addition facts would actually be a composite skill, right? So your components literally would be, just counting. So oral chains, it could be number identification, a one-to-one correspondence. So then you would go ahead and you'd combine like rote counting with one-to-one correspondence with identification of numerals and a number line, and you'd put those together, right, to begin to teach basic number combinations. And the same thing, and the subitizing goes in there as well. I'm not doing a good job on the specific scope and sequence, but the point is you got to know each of those. And just to get something off my chest, like one of the things that just bothers me so much about kind of the math vernacular is this whole notion of procedural fluency, because under that definition, they include both declarative facts and procedure. So what we know plus how we know. And when I work with students, it's really important to task analyze, because those are two different skills, right? It's like, the what of which, and then how you use that what and how you combine those to, kind of build on those larger concept pieces.
It's certainly a problem that we see in a lot of materials, and I'm sure we'll loop back later in how these are sequenced, whether or not they're taught explicitly or not, whether or not kids are given enough practice in them before moving to something that, requires you to bring that skill to bear in a much larger, more complex problem. Math facts has kind of become, I thought after the reading wars that it would become the new phonics kind of thing, and it's been slower. And for example, I was at a school just recently, and a teacher said to everyone, after I was giving the example of how math facts are so important to being able to do, like, for example, a law, the algorithm, the standard algorithm. And she said, but we know that teaching math facts interferes with understanding. So I don't know why we're even bringing this up. Is she right? Like, do we know that?
We do not know that. I would say that is a trope, and it's put forth, unfortunately, by NCTM. I mean, they really do talk a lot about, we don't want kids to memorize now. And they will say, well, if they memorize through the use of procedures, that's fine. And what I would, and to me, it's a little bit of a purple hat thing, right? Like they use math facts, but if you want to be, and the thing is, I feel sorry for teachers, right? Because I know they're sitting there in their classrooms and they're scratching their head and they're like, conceptual understanding is really important. But I also know that facts are important, and I keep getting these mixed messages, but they always tie it to math facts. And what I want people to think about is a fact or a declarative fact, when we remove it from procedural fluency, is a discrete stimulus response, right? So I see a three, I know it's a three. Okay, like those are facts kids need to learn. We need to teach them to identify numbers, to write numbers, right? And those are very discrete facts. But then we also, and like a verbal chain would be a fact. And so then we go ahead and we teach a procedure. And so a procedure might be one-to-one correspondence. And then let's say we want to teach the concept of more, right? Now that they can count set, let's say they can subitize and count sets. Now we can have them look, is this, and they have cardinality, right? It's okay, well, is this the same? Is it smaller? Is it bigger? And we can begin to build that vocabulary, which is a fact. And one of the things I like to say is today's concept is tomorrow's fact. I have a 5-year-old, and I'll say like, what's 3 plus 2, sweetheart? And she'll hold up her fingers, right? She looks at it and she counts 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, and then she'll be 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And to her, to know that this many fingers means five, or this kind of concept of cardinality, like that's a concept to her. But very soon she will just see a three and she'll be able to subitize, and that concept becomes a fact that then she'll use with a number line, and she can scan that number line, identify that number, and then have the one-to-one correspondence to count on from that number. So now we got a fact, a procedure, and now we're teaching the concept of addition. Right. And so this whole notion of people, like, you can memorize math facts at the wrong time when you don't have the prerequisite skills, and it's probably not good for learning. Okay. And so it's plausible, right, that memorizing facts can preclude understanding. Like my daughter right now can, she can, since she can do sums to 10, right, I can give her 1,222,222 plus the same, and she can go ahead and she could do that. Like, she could do all the combinations of numbers, but if I but she doesn't have the declarative skill of reading the number. Does that make sense? And so, like, she can do the problem, she doesn't understand anything, but the straw man is that anybody would be dumb enough to teach that skill to that kid with that level of knowledge and, like, pat themselves on the back. We would never do it, right? But whether it's teaching cardinality, there are very specific facts that kids have to have. And when they don't have to concentrate on what that fact is, and they can focus on using the procedure in different ways, that's when we begin to build. Conceptual understanding is what, people say. As a behaviorist, I would say you're beginning to look at academic stimuli, and you're beginning to discriminate when and when not to use certain facts and procedures, right? So take it forward to math facts, right? Like in my Facts on Fire program, before you even go to sums to six, you're doing something called dot number, which is subitizing, and then you do dot number total, where once you have already consumed it, subitized, now you're adding two dot arrays, right? And you're using counting skills to put together two quantities to get at the addition. So there's concepts being taught, right? We even use those dot arrays to identify the larger number and count up, right? And so we talk about count all, count by, count up, which are all important prerequisite skills. So then when they see 4 plus 5 in an abstract format with numerals, they can identify their numbers fluently, they can count fluently, they can subitize, they've been taught vocabulary, and now they're ready to do those number combinations. Okay, so at this point we can either have them count themselves to death until they memorize the facts, or we can kind of remove the procedure and put in more drill-based activities to get kids to memorize the fact. And so now the argument becomes, is it better to just have a kid count themselves to death to finally make the association, right? So 3 plus 1 is 4, which it's pretty easy for kids to do if they do a count up, because it's three and then it's one procedure, and then they get the answer, right? So they pair 3, 1, 4, and then they get that to memory. The problem is, right, is if we get to 8 plus 6, and now a kid, they say 8, and then it's 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and then all of this mental energy or working memory was flooded because of reliance on a counting procedure. Okay, and so where I think NCTM gets it wrong, in my opinion, and there's research to back what I'm about to say up, but like them thinking you go from count all to count by to count up to decomposition, and then when you do the decomposition, the memorization will come, runs, I think, counter to learning theory.
Absolutely. So it's interesting because you and I are both on online, and you see like parents posting pictures of different curricula and maybe criticizing their child's homework and so on. This may not have been how I learned this, and so on. And it's always about sequencing with like what you just mentioned about like what you did with dots. Like other programs might use lines, or it doesn't really matter, right? The analysis of basically how to work a problem and all of those component skills that can be done differently, but it includes, if it's a good analysis, the same components. It kind of looks a little fuzzy, like fuzzy math when you're looking at why are my kids drawing dots or making dot arrays or drawing lines when we should just have them memorize them, but it's part of a sequence, a part of a design, a curricular view that eventually we fade out to the point where the kid just can say them automatically because we're actually getting into harder math. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And so, and I would agree with, and I agree with NCTM on a lot of things, right? Like, for example, decomposition is like, I want my kids to decompose numbers too. I would just be a proponent that the memorization of basic facts, right, which was a concept before, right? Like, at some point, once the kids can demonstrate, they realize that it's parts and you combine them, and now it's time to memorize that and make it a fact. And that fact is to br the bridge to use decomposition skills. And actually, this is what happens, but NCTM just proponents seem to don't want to openly talk about this, but I'm going to explain this to your listeners, and I hope it makes a lot of sense.
Maybe define decomposition strategy.
Decomposition. So I could sit there and do 5 plus 6, okay? Or I could do 6 plus 8. And decomposition is breaking that down, right? So if it's 5 plus 6 and a kid, so 5 plus 5 plus 1, right? Like
Right.
that. And then if they're looking at 8 plus 6, but let's say all, you know, if they knew their fives, right, they would know, oh, well, that's 5 plus 1, and that's five plus, what did I say? 6 plus 8, 5 plus 1, and 5 plus 3. It's already taxed in my working memory. But then if they know 5 plus 5, now we got a 10, and we got 4 ones because we got 1 plus 3, right? And so that's just a way that, you know, they can break things down. So they make fives, they make tens. And this is really important in mental math, right? Like, if I'm going to go ahead and present students 2-digit by 1-digit or 2-digit by 2-digit numbers horizontally, and they can't kind of, like, you know, present that in for a standard algorithm, basically by kind of chunking these approaches, kids can use the limited amount of working memory they have by making tens or doing other things, you know, to come up with that. And when people say kids understand, when I ask them, what does that mean? The kid can do things in multiple ways, in multiple situations, and can tell you, or in my eyes, discriminate when or when not to use certain strategies. Now, I think that the criticism comes in is that the kid just memorizes 5 plus 6 and they know it's 11, and it's immediately retrieved, right? So it's just a one step. Wouldn't even call it a procedure. It's just a declarative fact. Then, like, why is a kid gonna engage in a multi-step task when they just have it memorized? I think that's where some of the memorization of math facts blocks decomposition. But actually, there was a study, and I don't know if you post these things, but it's a great study by Vasileva and colleagues, and they looked at American and I think it was Korean students, first grade students, and they looked at counting procedures, immediate retrieval, and decomposition. And what they found was that when kids had their facts memorized, when they were asked to do mental math tasks, a much higher percentage compared to American kids actually engaged in those decomposition strategies. And so if I could sit down with a constructivist teacher and say, what are our goals for our kids? And they said, well, I want to see them be flexible. And I said, well, how do kids behave? Well, I want them to be able to answer these problems, but also explain what they're doing and why they're doing it and how they're doing it. Then I would task analyze that to say, right, like, okay, so what strategies do you want to teach them? What are the prerequisites needed? So if we want to, like, teach make fives, then obviously they have to deconstruct everything from 5 plus 5 or 5 plus 4 to 5 plus 1, right? And then you would need to set them up with very predictable, like, 6 plus 8, 7 plus 7, whatever it may be. They could do, oh, 5 plus 2, 5 plus 2, 10, and 4. But if they don't have 5 plus 5 and 2 plus 2 memorized, now they're counting, and they'll overwhelm their working memory, and they'll offload it to paper. They'll never memorize a fact, and they'll really won't get you know, quick op they won't get high rates of responding to be able to juxtapose the multiple strategies to ever learn them. And so by taking out the memorization piece, they're actually hindering kids' ability to move to that decomposition. And so it's like, I want to be friends. I want to have a beer around the fire and enjoy life, right? Like, I get where you guys want to go. I want kids to go there too. Let's be as efficient as possible and let's use predictable learning theory so that this happens. And so again, count on, count all, count on, count or count by, count up, memorize your facts, now teach your decomposition strategies. And what I was going to say is the decomposition strategy that works so well is doubles plus or minus one. The only reason it works so well is because kids memorize their doubles. Like, no fool would sit there and be like, watch my kid use doubles plus one. What's 8 plus 7? Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14. Plus one, 15. Like, that would be the most preposterous, dumb thing ever. But in the same token, they're literally saying, don't memorize your facts, then go to decomposition strategies, which is in essence, like, I'm gonna have to count to make my tens and then count to subtract. They're literally promoting that. And it makes, to me, it makes no sense from at least a behavioral learning theory, but I realize not very many teachers probably get a healthy dose of behavioral learning theory in their undergrad prep.
Well, the making a 10 strategy that you mentioned, like this, I'm very familiar with because m many new materials use that as a, I guess, an organizing structure, and it delays and it prohibits a lot of like the a lot of practice with lots of problems. It sort of I feel like it shrinks the problem set pretty quickly, and it puts it off, and oftentimes programs just don't include enough math fact practice throughout the year, and then now they're going for other, now teachers have to look for other solutions. I'm just my I'm curious, like instead of introducing fact memorization through some of these decomposition strategies that you say actually do leverage memorization, instead of using that to occasion like the memorization of facts, how do you suggest or program, design the instructions to embed or encode those facts initially? I find so much. It's really easy to just test just 1 minute time everything, and you end up having kids practicing things they don't know how to do. And so there needs what's missing, I feel like a lot of times, is a way of introducing and setting kids up so that their practice is more successful.
Yes, definitely. And so, again, just so everybody's clear, I am all for the counting and the conceptual understanding and leading every. So, when a kid could show you with multiple representations, use a number line, they can communicate what addition is. Now I'm like, stop. Now let's memorize. And so, when a kid has this, you can take out all the zeros. So, to me, it's all about set size, right? And it's all about mass practice, space practice, interleave practice. And so, what we need to do is shrink sets so we can use our time really wisely. Because the other thing we know with retrieval practice, we've done studies where the shorter the duration, the higher the learning rates or the learning per instructional minute. Okay, and so, what we need, so we throw out zeros and ones, and that literally is 33% of all your items. Right. And then after that, what we have found in our research is that if a kid knows 2 plus 3, a majority of them know 3 plus 2. So now, you take out the zeros and ones, you're left with 72 problems. You take out the reciprocals, and now you're literally left with like 36 problems. Now that's a pretty manageable thing, right? So then, like, the Facts on Fire program that I have, how it's set up is in 3 sets of 12, and then, like, when you start the set of 12, each day it's 4 items. We used a time delay procedure called tape problems, and so the students, because since you're in a classroom and this is class wide, right, we would go ahead and have that antecedent behavioral consequent, right, kind of instruction, so just a learning trial. And we would do like 4 items, we do 6 repetitions, and then immediately we go to a timed retrieval practice, but it's only over like those 4 items. Right. And so it's right back to back, but it's like we structured and, so they just pair the stimulus and the response, and then we allow them to retrieve that. And that takes about 5 minutes.
So
And
like the tape problem goes like this. I'm just trying to think, like, and tell me if I'm wrong. It will say like 4 plus 1 equals 5, five
that's right.
plus one equals 6, 6 plus 1 equals 7. It will
Correct.
say the full fact with the answer, and then it's followed immediately by another tape problem with a blank that the kid says. Or let me wrap my head around that.
Yeah, no. So that would be more of a flashcard. Like, I'm going to provide an intact model. 4 plus 1 is 5. What's 4 plus 1? And the kid can mimic it, right? And so while the learning is errorless, it's not very powerful because the kid's not retrieving. So tape problems provides a delay. And so if I go like 6 plus 3 is 9, right? And you do that because you want a child, if they can, to retrieve it, because that's going to be the most powerful. But if a child can't, you're not going to let them just sit there and flounder for 5 or 6 seconds and have low rates of responding. So you're going to go ahead and then provide them with the answer, and they can write it down. They're going to go through the other three problems, and then boom, they get another repetition, another repetition, another repetition, and another repetition. And so by the time that's all said and done, when they see 6 plus 3, they should know 9. Now, if we stop there, probably they're going to forget it. But now you yoke in the timed retrieval practice, right? And again, and there's goal setting involved in that, but then there they have to retrieve that problem. Now, what's really interesting is with those small sets, if I do this with a child for 3 days, and I see that, like, they're not responding, like when they do the retrieval practice, they're getting 2 right. Then you stop right away and you're like, something's wrong. There's probably a prerequisite skill missing. Let's slice back and test. That's the other thing, is we don't sit there and just drill and kill kids. Like, we provide them with highly controlled instructional environments so they can be effective. If it's not effective, we're testing that outcome within session every day. And if that doesn't work, we immediately will go back, assess prerequisites, look at what they have the mastery, and we will go back and fill in those gaps before we would do that.
Love it. You mentioned a word there, mastery. I feel like that's sort of a misunderstood concept. I feel like we kind of throw that word around, and often teachers aren't taught to teach to mastery across all the subjects. What flows from mastery? And I suppose even before that, what is it?
Yeah, exactly. People don't agree on what mastery is. And furthermore, it's just not a simple concept, right? Because, I'm teaching my daughter. She's doing her sums to 18. She's in second grade, and she started my program. She on lesson 15. So after she got those first 12 items, when I tested her on those, she was at 29 problems per minute, which was 49 digits correct per minute. Now, in my own programs, I have said in the past, 40 digits per minute is mastery. And now I'm saying 30 problems, because I'm trying to simplify it so people just aren't all over the place. But really, what I'm looking at, right, is I'm really saying, like, I want kids to immediately retrieve the fact. The problem is, when I give a 1 minute test, it is an aggregate score. So if I'm teaching 12 problems, 24, or testing on 12, 24, 36 items, whatever it may be that the kid has, let's say I have, it's random, the zeros and ones, let's say they could do it within a second, but then there might be a subset of items that would they would use a strategy in. And so if our goal is to extinguish strategies so they can have immediate retrieval, so then we can, kind of combine those into those decomposition strategies, then we need a measurement that, like, tells us, is the child using, because a kid could use a doubles plus or minus one strategy and be pretty darn fast at their fact, right? Because it's only, think about it, like, it is literally 3 steps. I get the double. I determine whether the problem needs to be added or subtracted, and then I count. Or maybe they have that. So you're looking at 2 to 3. So again, you can look fluent, but you're still strategy dependent. And if you're strategy dependent, you're consuming working memory. And so when you go to those decomposition strategies, like, I want to juxtapose multiple decomposition strategies side by side, and I want kids focused on the interconnectedness of those and why you do it. I don't want them, like, consuming their mind with those procedures. So the precision teaching people, they're pretty fanatical with their criteria. They'll say we want kids at like first, second graders at 40 to 60 problems per minute. That takes a time commitment, right? People hear about mastery criterion and it's different. We make estimates. Like when we're working with classrooms, we have to make hard decisions. I was just on the Science of Math Facebook page today, and someone's like, "Well, I got some kids in there at 20, but you say 30. Can I move them on?" And it's like, "Well, I mean, you got a classroom. You need to think about efficiency. But from a purist standpoint, you want kids to retrieve the problems. And so when you measure them, if they're at 30 problems per minute, they're averaging 2 seconds. You hope that's sufficient that as you interleave these with like, because if they're doing decomposition, they're still going to be practicing those problems. So you hope with the additional practice, they'd automatize it if they hadn't already, but you certainly hope they have automatized a majority of the problems.
I think that a lot of people will ask some common questions. Can we kind of do like a rapid fire for the facts on fire guy? Can we do some rapid fire?
Yeah, keeping me brief is like swimming in the ocean, but we'll try.
Well, one of those is like you're talking about like trying to wean them off of some of these strategies or these crutches that they use because sort of like with the reading analogy, like you kind of you don't want them to use inefficient strategies like three cueing or look at the picture. You just want to sound it. You want them to sound it out quickly, and so the equivalent is you just want them to solve the problem very quickly so that they can start doing higher level math. What about fingers? Like, what is the role of counting on your fingers? Does it have a role in early math before addition? Does it continue to have a role? Do you tell kids, put your hands under your desk? Like, what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it is a natural progression of those initial counting strategies. Again, my 5-year-old counts on her fingers, and that's just fine. She also counts Cheerios. She counts blocks. So this is, think about it. So she basically has the verbal chain memorized, right? Again, she has to have something memorized before she uses a procedure, which is the one-to-one correspondence. And so now that she has the fact and the procedure memorized, now she's working on generalization. And she's like, holy smokes, I can count anything. I can count Cheerios, I can count apples, I can count toys, right? And that is a generalization piece. And after a while, again, that concept becomes a fact. And so, and that's the whole point is like, once they get it, like to me, I always say we count kids to death. That's what we see when we see third graders still counting on their fingers, 5 plus 6. And so there's no reason why any child should do that. I mean, I've taught kids with IQs of 55 to memorize their facts. But look at the precision teaching people. You have to shrink the set, increase the repetitions, and some kids learn slower than others. That's why we should have tiered supports. We should have screeners in place, and we shouldn't be getting these kids in second or third grade. You should already know in kindergarten who needs more repetitions and if and who forgets more, right? Because if we even think about like retrieval practice and how we kind of learn and we forget and we relearn and we forget, it's like some kids just need more opportunities to do that. And so, as a behaviorist, if we can go in, and again, we do this in tiered supports with intervention. We get classroom teachers can't do this. But then this is why you need really good empirically based tiered intervention, that builds those tool skills to automaticity so that, they can go ahead and kind of teach those applications. And you're probably going to see how kids respond to those discrete, because if a child has trouble learning and maintaining really simple declarative facts, what do you think is going to happen when you start combining facts and procedures and having them, look at the interconnectedness of multiple like mathematical phenomena, right? Like this is probably going to be even harder to teach. It's going to take more repetitions.
I feel like it's a myth. I feel like it's not talked about it as much, but there's this sense that or even just directly said that math fact learning, fine, it works for it works for higher performing kids, but lower performing kids, they need a different they need to stick to the So-called conceptual kind of ways of doing it. It's gonna hold them back. It's gonna take a lot. It's gonna be really effortful for them to learn all of these things. They're gonna feel worse about themselves. And so, really, sure, if you want to do it with your high-performing kid at home, but don't subject the kids with special educational needs to this intervention. And you're basically saying the opposite. Am I right?
Yeah, again, I mean, find me the experimental research wherein query learning has been used to successfully increase math fact fluency in intellectually disabled students. Please send it to me. If anybody out there's got it, I'd love to see it. Because I can send you somewhere where, basic flashcard tape problems. And again, we have to do mass practice. We have to do distributed practice. You just have to I mean, it's the same practice things that the cognitive psychologists talk about. It's masked, but you don't stop there, right? You teach new masked things, you combine them. And even when you do that, like, okay, now as you fold in more things, it's gonna take more repetitions. And then you're gonna have decay and relearning. And so it's just a much more systematic, like kids that have learning disabilities, we'll get them the 40 digits correct and then they'll forget it, right? But then when you reintroduce the intervention, they get back to 40 a heck of a lot quicker than the initial. And so, but if we don't have inductive data, progress monitoring data to show those patterns, we don't know, exactly how to structure our day. Like, for example, and the other thing too is you would never sit down and drill kids for 15 minutes straight, right? So you'll do a 5 minute, but you may do a 5 minute drill activity 2 times a day. And if that doesn't work, you may do it 4 times a day. Okay. Like, and then you could also, if you've maximized your dose, then that's when you may go ahead and decrease your set, right? So you could start with a set of 8 and you would literally see within day, because you would test them at the end of it, like the precision teaching people did, how much did they learn within session? And then the next day, what did they remember from that? And you systematically introduce different sets to find that sweet spot for what they learn within session. And then you get the most maintenance, the following day. And if we do that, we begin to eat that elephant one bite at a time. But to me, most fact practice programs in schools are, like they'll do on Fridays and they include zeros and ones. And the dumbest thing is people literally have kids practice sums to 20. And sums to 20 is such a waste of drill time, right? Because you're literally just having kids practice column addition with sums to 10. And those probably aren't the problems they're going to have. And think about it, you're taking like the larger numbers that they need more practice on away, and they're getting less exposure to them. And so we have to be very like, what my goal is with my research and everything is I know teachers got better things to do than teach this, like, because they're following core curricula and they have their instructional goals are much more advanced. I'm trying to give them. Give me 5 minutes a day. Let me design it. I will give you the most efficient package possible. And if you do it every day, it will like take care of itself. If you incorporate this, and I can't emphasize this enough, it's got to be every day. It's got to start in kindergarten, and it needs to be preventative. Because when you see those kids not making that within session growth, like even when they're oral counting or number identification, it's like put on more steam. You realize you have to double that dose, and you have to begin to find like what those kids are going to need as far as more intensive intervention, so that you can keep them up close to those other students. So their knowledge gap isn't there, so they can access your core curriculum, right? And again, and you're not going to catch a freaking kid up in third grade, and then you're going to be, well, I'm teaching multiplication, and my goodness, they can't even add, and what do I do? And they're tearing their hair out, and I agree with them, right?
That is a question people bring up to me a lot. They say, like, okay, I understand if we start early, but look, we've got all these kids that are already here, right? And it's like, and we sort of dropped the ball on math facts for years, and it just feels wrong. It feels unethical to sort of take kids out of the core instruction to teach them something that they may use a little bit less of if we bring them all the way back to addition, basically. I mean, what are your thoughts on that implementation, like the implementation strategy for a whole school? You're starting fresh, you kind of drop the ball on math facts. You got kids who are just kind of past, it feels like kind of past the point of going all the way back. What do you do?
Yeah, welcome to my life.
Yeah.
The first facts on fire I ever did was fully differentiable. And so you could have kids all over the place, and we use cover copy compare and timed retrieval practice or explicit timing, and all the kids could work, at their own pace and at their own skill, and that was awesome. But until like the fourth graders got it and they tested their kids, and like, I don't know, like 30, 40% of them were on sums to 10, and another 30, 40% were on, sums to 18. And then the high kids, a lot of times they were still deficient in subtraction, right? And then the teacher's sitting here being like, I'm teaching like common denominators and things like this. And so, and so in my core, I'm teaching multiplication and how to apply it. But now they're using addition over here, and it doesn't make sense, right? Because you're in essence doubling the set, you're doubling what people need to learn. And so, in that case, I mean, the goal should be, because you should be able to teach most kids in your class to be fluent in multiplication facts, and I would say about 8 to 10 weeks. And you should be able to get them about, to that 30 to 50 digit correct per minute range. And if you do that, now they can access your core instruction. And so in that case, I would say like, okay, we know by our assessments that K-1-2-3 ain't doing their jobs. But, we can't fix that now, but we can go ahead and we can incorporate facts on fire, like as you would see in the general sequence for K1 and maybe even 2, but for for fourth, fifth, and sixth, we're just going to start at multiplication, and we'll backfill as we see necessary. And now that being said, the caveat is kids need to be able to add accurately, right? Like if a kid can't add, how are you going to teach them that multiplication is repeated addition and those types of things? And so again, don't straw man me and make me sound like I'm saying I don't care, just drill them. It's just like anything else. Look at the task, analyze, look at the prerequisite skills. If a kid is slow and accurate and has and understands how and when to use the procedures, what people would call understanding, then I'm okay moving and just focusing on memorize. Like if you realize that 3 times 6 are 6 groups of 3 or 3 groups of 6, okay, quit drawing your number arrays to the side, memorize the damn problem,
Yeah.
right? And let's move forward. And so you can act, because think about it, right? I'm saying spend 5 minutes a day so that you can access the 45 to 60 minutes a day you get in math. And it's that's I'm just finishing up writing a study where we did a 5-year explicit timing intervention. We literally did it in a school for 5 years, and it took 2 years to show an effect, but once we did, our effect size was up around a 0.6. Kids went from like the 30th percentile up to about the 80th percentile on their state test scores. But it took time, right? Because you had to fill all of these things, and if first graders got it, then they accessed the first grade curriculum better, and everything was cumulative, right? And so it's just, like school districts need to think about is fact fluency is important. They need to like leave the guilt at the door. Memorizing facts isn't going to preclude kids from conceptual understanding. It's actually going to help your teachers teach conceptual understanding, or again, as I will say, discriminating when to use facts and procedures in response to certain stimuli, and be able to verbally tell you how and why they're doing it. Okay, and so, but if you, and again, we just got a grant, and we're working in some schools in the Fort Worth area, and we're going to replicate this effect. And if we find it, then we're going to have a couple of research studies that show, because there's a lot of research studies that show that like explicit timing and tape problems and flashcard drill, that it works really well, but they're always really short run studies, like a month, and it's over like a limited amount of problems. So it doesn't mean really, it doesn't mean a lot as far as broad math skills. But what we're showing is if you do a dedicated approach to systematically building fact fluency, what it does is it basically accentuates the great things that your teachers are doing in the confines of their core curriculum. And that's really important.
I want to actually talk a little bit about integrating a math fact program with a core curriculum that doesn't do the work. I mean, I think most people can imagine you can subtract those parts if there is like a really weak math fact kind of component to the core program, just kind of skip those parts or, you use them selectively and focus more on the systematic one, like Facts on Fire. But there's also, I'm sure you, as you work with schools, there's also a lot of like logistical things. Like the 4 minutes for some teachers takes 20 minutes, and for other teachers it takes even less time. It's a management thing, an implementation thing. I mean, how are you seeing the role of some of these kind of practical sort of implementation concerns playing out in terms of being more efficient, saving more time, getting more kids on task?
Yeah, what you're talking about is everything. And so, like with Facts on Fire, I've redone it and I released something this year. And because what I realized is like certain teachers that just, they eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff, they would use it and they would make the weekly copies and they would stuff the folders and then they'd try to roll it out school wide. And people were like, I don't have time to take a restroom break. Like, I don't, whatever. And so, what I've done now is teachers will print out notes, so they'll assess their class, they'll figure out like this would be the best place since it's a tier one, everybody gets the same thing. And then they literally have slide decks, and every kid has a workbook. The principal will go to the announcements, they sing songs, they do chants, fun stuff, get them fired up. Literally, the teacher pushes play on the slide deck. I mean, the kids open up their books, the slide deck does the tape problems, it reads the directions, it has the timings, and instructs the students to count the number of problems they completed, to set their goals. Everything is baked into the program, and the teacher's sole job is to walk around that room and catch kids doing great, being good, high five and fist bump and cheering them on, and they love it. And I mean, literally, like kids are dancing, teachers are happy because they're seeing kids happy. And like a lot's made out of growth mindset and things of that. Like kids are seeing, like it's predictable, and they're seeing growth. And so now, as a teacher, you can have those discussions about effort and working hard to try and get these things done. And that there's the fruits to your labor. The whole, what does motivation come from? Well, it comes from achievement and success. And was small, like on my daughter, when I tested her, she started out literally at 12 problems right on the pretest. So that was all 36 items. And then we went ahead and we did, the first day where we did the four problems with six repetitions with the Facts on Fire, and she scored like 23. So just boom, like because of the small set, she found, a lot of this success, right? And so, and then what the program does is it slowly builds in more and more problems. And kids aren't necessarily good, the dots aren't going up the page, they're staying high on the page though. And there's a research study done by Pavlov and Duhon, and they looked at on-task rates when kids did explicit timing. And if kids were above 20 digits correct per minute, they were on task 95% of the time. If they were below 20, like around that 10 to 15 range, they were on task only about 55% of the time. And so it's like getting kids to be successful each day. I mean, it's just high rates of responding. It's exciting. It's fun. They're trying to get to, warm, hot, on fire, nuclear if they're super fast. And it's just a really, so it's fun, it's short duration, it's high intensity, all the instruction is taken care of, and literally all they got to do is to have them take the book out. So it's easy in, it's easy out, and literally the only re everything I did in this program was because of teachers telling me, this is what I don't like about your program. The first one with the printing, and they were just like all the things you're talking about. And so, the Facts on Fire 2.0 is literally for teachers, almost by teachers. I mean, I did it, but I just listened because they're the ones that know. They're in the schools, they're implementing it.
How do you recommend teachers go about like correcting math facts? Because I've seen this sort of take up a lot of time, and I've seen this being done in a way that either they take it all and they do it themselves and the kids don't engage in self-correcting, or they do self-correcting but it takes a ton of time and it's not really everyone that's participating. What are your thoughts on like error corrections for math facts?
If I were a teacher and I was doing a lot of error correction, then you're doing the wrong intervention. And so, what I would do is use cover copy compare, and I would steer people away from that because kids also, when they're young, they struggle with writing a lot. Tape problems and I've done lots of research. Cover copy compare works. It just doesn't work as good as tape problems. And tape problem has that antecedent. So they see the problem, they hear the problem, they write the answer. If they can't write the answer, they get it. And so there's feedback, but the feedback is built into the intervention every single day. And so you shrink the set, you give them instruction that provides immediate feedback, not after they do it. Right. So in explicit timing, we give performance feedback. We're like, you did 1 minute or 2 minutes of time practice. Count how many items you got right, because they should be accurate on those. Right. And so they can get feedback on, oh, I got 26 right this day, but I got 29 the next. If a child's inaccurate, you don't want them to do an entire sheet and then be like, oh, by the way, you missed these 10, right? You want to say, okay, if they're inaccurate, let's go to the small sets and let's provide them with immediate feedback every single time they do a problem. And so then it takes the feedback component out of the students' hands, which it's not their job anyway. And it becomes more immediate, so it should have a larger impact on accurate responding.
That makes total sense. And I'm thinking more of like the when they get to the larger set, like this these long labored correction procedures that teachers are told to do, but they shouldn't by the time they're getting to that larger set, they should all be largely all correct.
Yes.
So that they need immediate feedback when it comes to accuracy instruction, and there's more of a delayed feedback procedure for just a very small number of items in the fluency stage because they're meant to do a lot of problems, and it would just like it would take away the number of problems they can do.
Yeah, and again, we know you should never do retrieval practice. We did. Robin Cotting did the first study back in 2007. I did one with some students, and I published it in 2021. And it literally said, if kids are below 10 digits correct per minute, do not do timed test or time practice. Use cover copy compare, use tape problems. But if kids are above that 10 digit correct per minute, threshold, then the data showed they responded. But if you do time, so again, it's like timed practice is a wonderful thing, but don't do it with students that are low. Now, the Facts on Fire program, by isolating those small sets and slow and systematically interleaving, even if a kid starts low, if you look at their first 3 days of in the intervention, technically you would see if they were popping above, that kind of recommended place within session. But that would be an artifact of the instruction of the stimulus response feedback with the tape problems, but also with the retrieval practice built in there. And you would know right away whether that was working or not for that child. And if it wasn't, you would know either to double the dose or just remove them and work on slice back to some prerequisite skills.
Love it. Just a couple more questions. I could talk to you all day about this. Like, honestly, it's like, and the folks that are sticking with us, they're like, "Arr!" And the other people are like, "Well, how did I get on to what a nerding out session about math facts?" But, go back and look at the other episodes, folks. There's ones on reading and writing and everything else. You kind of mentioned this like interleave set and then like the isolated, the kind of introductory set. How does this look? Like, is there like a line? Is it a different sheet? Do you delay the interleaved or cumulative set? Like, this is something that I feel like I picked up on intuitively as a teacher without a program. I kind of created two ways of doing this, but how you say systematic, how does this feed into the interleave set and how do you make those determinations,
Yeah, you make your best guess as an instructional designer, and then you kind of adapt as you go. With the Facts on Fire program, I did four because, again, with students with intellectual disability, I've used four items and they've got it. And so, since it's a tier one, what I want to do is lift every kid up. I don't want to teach to the middle of the class. I teach to the bottom because you're not, since it's a fluency building program, you're not going to over-automatize the fact, right? And so, and if it's done systematically in a tiered system, you're doing it at the right time. You're not having kids in fourth grade do sums to 10. That would be a waste of their time, right? And so what I do is I start with four items. I mean, so there's 12 items in the set. I'll go with the first four, and I repeat that 2 days. And then on the third day, I'll go ahead with tape problems, and I fold one out and I fold one in, and I'll do that until all. It's eight problems on sums to six, sums to 10, subtraction. It's 12 problems from addition to 18, multiplication to 81, right? But on the 10th lesson, the kid has been exposed to everything, right? Through the tape problems, Facts on Fire, explicit timing sheet. Then lessons 11 through 15, now it is all timed practice. And if you look at the assessments, for the first 4 days, it's only like four problems or six problems. And then as we introduce all the problems, now it's all 12 problems, but it's not even random, right? Like I have two repetitions of the four problems from that set of lessons, and then I have the old ones, and then I have them randomized so that basically they're interleaved. And then we do that as we, put in. Like if we go six problems, 12 problems, 18, 24, 30, 36 problems. So by the end of the program, they're literally doing random sets of all 36 items.
Love it, love it. And if I could add a practitioner's tip for doing this, what how it falls outside of the curriculum. And I'm adding this practitioner's tip in, folks, because I'm in a sort of podcast war with Anna Stocky, and so this is my way of trying to boost the viewership. But I suppose one of the things I kind of learned to do is don't ignore what you see as you're walking around with these explicit timings. Like you see a number that just kind of sticks out to you, a fact that. And that sort of same kids are kind of getting wrong, maybe the same two kids, and just do a delayed oral test like in the hallway. Like do it as you're walking to recess when they're standing at the door and they're about to come in, and you just go, you know what? I bet you can't remember this one, guys. 6 plus 2. Remember 6 plus 2? And you get everybody, and then check in with that kid, Billy, who got it wrong, and say, like, and Billy, one more time, what's 2 plus 6? I just think using these programs with fidelity because of how they're designed is important, and then sort of taking the next step and just meet, and using that information to just kind of do these little itty bitty interventions. I just find that personally important. Brian, it has been so great to have you on the podcast. You've mentioned some research and things you've been working on. What is next for you?
Let's say, so theoretically, we're doing a lot of research on dose and set. And so we're literally like looking at, we just did a study where we literally did tape problems so we controlled rates of responding, but we did like one repetition, four repetition, eight repetition, 12 repetition, and over the same 12 problems, and we begin to look at how kids respond to that. And so what we found were patterns where you got the most bang for your buck with the first minute. And then you got diminishing returns as you went up to 4 minutes and 8 minutes and 12 minutes. Although when you went up, they always learned more. And the reason why this is so important to me is because it's all about prevention, right? And so, so what we know is that the more, and your practical advice was fantastic because we know that short duration, high intensity retrieval practice is important. We did one study, it was done by Schutte et al.'s 2015, and we did 1 4-minute block versus 2 2-minute blocks, and then it was 4 1-minute blocks. And the 2 2-minute block and the 4 1-minute blocks separated actually produced about 20 to 25% more learning without changing instructional time. And then my big project now is I'm working with those Fort Worth area schools. So we're doing, we're down there, and at this point it's a service project, but we are gonna, hopefully collect some data. And so we are kind of fine-tuning the facts on fire in the schools, where we got coaches, administrators, teachers giving us feedback on what works, what doesn't. And so we're really gonna, again, instead of researching it and giving it to teachers, we're gonna give it to teachers, iron out all the kinks, and then probably do some research and hopefully give teachers something that's a very low effort, very brief, but highly reinforcing, because you get to interact with your kids and see them grow. When you have parent-teacher conferences, you can whip out that Facts on Fire book and be like, here's where your kid started, here's where they ended. You can ask your kid, like, talk to your parent about this, and they can just be, and they'll love timing, they'll love being timed, they'll love be getting better, they'll feel they'll feel efficacious in math, all the bigger goals, that to feel like a mathematician, growth mindset, all those things. This is a fantastic tool to do that. And oh, by the way, the kids will have the prerequisite skills, so when you are yoked and told to, do said curriculum, whether it's IM or whatever, the kids are going to have better skills, so you'll be able to achieve those instructional goals. And so, I got about 10 years of hard running left in my career, and I hope in 10 years I leave teachers with a highly accessible, free tool that helps math achievement.
Love it. Let me know in the coming days how I can help you before you break down in those 10 years. Maybe you need someone to to work with you. I really appreciate it, Brian. It has just been great to talk with you about this important topic. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to Progressively Incorrect every week. I'd really appreciate it if you'd spread this around. It's one of those things you spend a lot of time on, and you just get a lot of feedback on, and I'm just always trying to get better. So I appreciate you tuning in. Brian, take care.
Yes, thank you so much.